Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel.
Like some on the right, severe right, came up with this Project 25, and I don't even know. I mean, some of them I know who they are, but they're very, very conservative. I don't know what the hell it is. It's Project 25.
Project 2025.
Project 2025.
Project 2025.
There's one person who definitely does not want to talk about it these days.
I don't know anything about it. I don't want to know anything about it.
I disagree with some of the things they're saying.
They are extreme.
Anything they do, I wish them luck, but I have nothing to do with them.
This is Project 2025. You've almost certainly heard about it already. It's the 920-page conservative manifesto that details the plan for the next Republican administration. In here, there's recommendations that'll dramatically increase presidential powers, kneecap regulatory institutions, carry out mass deportations, limit voting and abortion access, roll back trans rights, increase the powers of the surveillance state, and have it all ready to implement the day the next conservative president is elected. But if we've heard a lot about what's inside Project 2025, most of us know a lot less about the organization that's behind it. The Heritage Foundation. In this video, we're going to go behind the scenes and find out who they are, what they're even doing writing a document like this, and why this random organization seems to have such a massive influence on American politics. Okay, so if you've never heard about them before, the Heritage Foundation is a think tank. They do public policy research. Like most regular think tanks, they issue briefs, reports, and hold events, including this one about how diversity, equity, and inclusion is a problem. Nothing to say about the staffing of that panel. Anyway, all of that's relatively standard. What makes Heritage so unique among think tanks, though, is their, let's say, different understanding of what being a think tank means and just how influential they are. Because for all the distance Trump has tried to put between him and Heritage recently, here's him giving a speech at a dinner they hosted in 2022, saying how great they are.
Heritage does such an incredible job at that. This is a great group, and they're going to lay the groundwork and detail plans for exactly what our movement will do and what your movement will do when the American people give us a colossal mandate to save America. And that's coming. That's coming.
Here's him asking them for help in 2017.
We need the help of the Heritage Foundation.
Here are the recently leaked training videos for Project 2025 in which 29 out of the featured 36 people worked for Trump. And according to CNN, another 200 people worked for both Trump and Project 2025 behind the camera. To give you an idea, in 2018, Heritage claimed that Trump had implemented 64% of their last mandate for leadership plan, the 2015 version of Project 2025, in just his first year in office. They're clearly very influential. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. To really understand the Heritage Foundation, we have to rewind to the 1970s. Specifically, February 16th, 1973. That's the date Paul Weyrich and Edwin Fulner, with a $250,000 investment from Joseph Kors, yes, the beer guy, started Heritage.
Make it yours. Make it Kors.
1973 is a special year for think tanks, because it's the year when all the big ones actually already existed for decades. Brookings, NBER, AEA, and RAND, huge names in the Washington think tank bubble, were all already set up and exerting kind of a lot of influence on Washington. And not for no reason. For the previous 50-ish years, think tanks had become surprisingly relevant thanks to changes in the federal government. Specifically, the government had become a lot bigger and more complicated. Over the course of the 20th century, following the creation of the Federal Civil Service, Americans saw the government expand and start dealing with things it hadn't really bothered with before.
Public works, justice, progress, education, and freedom. The biggest bargain in history. American citizenship.
Things like antitrust, agriculture, transportation, communication, and food safety. A bit later, we saw the New Deal expand the government's scope even more. We got new social programs and dozens of new agencies and departments like the EPA, the Departments of Energy, Housing and Urban Development, and Health, Education and Welfare. Quickly followed by developments like the Interstate Highway System, Medicare, Medicaid, Pell Grants, and the National Flood Insurance Program. All in all, the 20th century came with the birth of a large and sometimes kind of unwieldy bureaucracy. To manage all this, it became clear that you needed public policy experts. Teams who could understand this huge web of people and resources and help government officials actually use these institutions. Think tanks filled that void. And for the most part, they did that in one of two ways. Sometimes, think tanks acted like universities, just without the students. Researchers were hired the same way they would be at a big school and given creative freedom to write reports that might someday be useful for policymakers. Or, think tanks acted more like private contractors. They'd have clients, most of the time the federal government itself, commissioning research projects on specific topics they needed particular analysis on. Regardless of what model they followed, though, most of them were nonpartisan. They produced high-quality research for both Republicans and Democrats designed to just help the government work better. Over time, though, these think tanks started showing a bit of bias. Because of their role, their job became highly technocratic. This naturally, slowly steered them towards perfecting the Keynesian welfare system that this new 20th century big government was set up for. The same model of government that made life generally less terrible and less dangerous for a good chunk of people living in the US. But not everybody was so happy with this trend. Specifically, the business community.
Greed is good.
Hey, you! What smells like big business?
The 20th century's turn towards actually useful government regulation and labor victories like the weekend, workplace safety measures, the abolition of child labor, and the social safety net all made work and life in general a little bit better for a lot of people. It pushed up wages, and that meant increased costs for business owners, which was good. Between 1966 and 1973, workers were slowly taking home a bigger and bigger share of the total national income that they produced, and started cutting into the profits going to the top 1%. And you can actually see them panicking. At meetings between heads of large industries in 1974 and 1975, Thomas Murphy, CEO of General Motors, said capitalists were getting, quote, clobbered. John Harper, chairman of Alcoa, said he felt powerless. James Ferguson, chairman for General Foods, said, quote, business was getting kicked around compared to labor. To be clear, they were still rolling in it, just a little less than before. But to top this all off, you had all these researchers and all these prominent Washington think tanks confirming what we already know to be obvious. Things that make life better for most people make capitalists less money. Safety, overtime pay, higher wages, sensible regulation. Those hurt business owners trying to squeeze out every cent of value. Basic human decency be damned. And these think tanks advocating reasonable policies had the federal government's ear. In the face of all that, CEOs were pretty worried that they were losing their power. So by the 1970s, they had had enough. They realized they were on the losing side of the intellectual battle and wanted their own little nerds who would spit out pro-business research. In conservative press like the Wall Street Journal and Public Interest, conservatives like Irving Kristol and William Simon were basically begging the business community to start funding explicitly pro-business, pro-limited government researchers. Essentially, people who'd try to turn back the clock on regulations and union wins so the wealthy could get wealthier faster again. And they recommended using corporate philanthropy going towards new, explicitly conservative think tanks as the way to get corporate hands back on the levers of government power. Enter the Heritage Foundation, a 501c3 ready to go to bat for big corporations. Almost immediately, this new voice in Washington attracted Dow Chemical, Gulf Oil, Mobil, Chase Manhattan Bank, General Motors, FMC, Sears and Roebuck, Reader's Digest, Bluebell, Dart and Kraft, and Pfizer, who all started pouring in donations. Very quickly, Heritage went from that $250,000 Coors seed money to a $10 million yearly budget in 1980, over $38 million in today's money. But still, for those first 5 to 7 years, no one really cared about Heritage. Most people thought it was, quote, an obscure far-right think tank with only a marginal impact on public affairs. That changed in 1980, when Reagan came to town. See, Heritage had figured out that the old university without students and federal contractor models wouldn't work. Investing time and energy into producing quality research would lead them down the same left-liberal path their corporate backers were specifically trying to avoid. they needed to do things differently. First, they gave up on the idea of giving researchers independence. Their organizational structure had, quote, researchers and support staff act strategically and in coordination, meaning they were looking for specific conservative conclusions from the outset and made sure their researchers would produce these results by keeping them on a tight leash. Second, Heritage stopped focusing on doing in-depth research. They instead focused on pretty surface-level work that would yield specific policy recommendations, not analysis, lightning-fast turnaround times, and even shrank the size of reports dramatically so they could pass what they called the briefcase test, meaning they were small enough to fit in a briefcase that could be read in basically no time at all. The point was to give Republicans curated talking points ASAP, not rigorous causal investigation. Third, Heritage aggressively marketed their research, not just so that they could get their arguments in front of policymakers, but to add astroturfed public pressure behind those arguments too. To this day, Heritage spends more on marketing than its peers, sends droves of its people on news programs to be experts, and has actively built a network of, in their words, 20,000 Sentinel activists and more than 2 million local grassroots activists. Through a separate organization called Heritage Action, the foundation has tens of thousands of people ready to call and email representatives and push for Heritage-funded policies, or just copy and paste tweets written by the foundation to flood social media with a carefully worded talking point at the drop of a hat. For all intents and purposes, Heritage is barely a think tank. It's an advocacy group with an astroturfing department. But back to the 80s. When Reagan won the election, Heritage finally had the opportunity to see if its strategy had paid off. In January of 1981, as Reagan was being sworn in for the first time, the Heritage Foundation published The Mandate for Leadership, Policy Management in a Conservative Administration. This 3,082-page report, written over a year by 250 people, wasn't like most think tank papers. Instead of giving general guidelines for the president to follow, or detailed research about different policy positions, it instead gave the president a list of specific, concrete recommendations tailored to each department. Recommendations like abolishing the Department of Energy, revoking affirmative action in government hiring and contracting, increasing the defense budget by $20 billion and military spending by $35 billion a year, deploying a neutron bomb in Europe, cutting social welfare and taxes on the rich, dramatically increasing the powers of the surveillance state by suspending the banning of wiretapping by the FBI, exempting the FBI from abiding by the Privacy Act, and restoring investigations into the, quote, loyalty of federal employees. All recommendations that reduced the role of the president to following along and checking off items on a list written by lackeys deep in the pocket of big business. And Reagan loved it. At his very first cabinet meeting, he handed out copies of the report to everyone, and shortly after, even hired people behind the report to work for him. According to Heritage, Reagan implemented over 60% of the mandate in his first term. And since then, Heritage, Republican administrations, and large corporations have stayed closely intertwined, as we've seen with the revolving door between Trump and Project 2025. Recently, though, that connection's become harder and harder to investigate. Nowadays, large corporations and the ultra-wealthy don't fund Heritage as overtly as they used to. Sure, Heritage releases the names of some of their donors, but thanks to what are called donor-advised funds, a lot of the wealth pouring in has been completely anonymized. These funds, operated by third-party financial institutions, aggregate donations and distribute them anonymously to less-than-savory charities like Heritage. Since 2020, over $18 million have come from these dark money funds, tax-free and with zero transparency, something that Project 2025 actually plans to make even easier and more anonymous. And according to some estimates, donor-advised funds held nearly $230 billion in assets in 2022. Still, we have some idea of what this influence can buy. In 2015, for example, we found out in an email leak that Lockheed Martin had donated over $340,000 to Heritage over the years. Far from some objective, research-first think tank, these donations got Heritage to produce a flurry of reports, glazing Lockheed's F-22 fighter jets and its sexy thrust vectoring engines, and claiming the Obama administration's plan to cut them out of the budget would basically doom the US. All the while, Lockheed knew that it stood to gain $412 million per plane if this sort of influence could get Congress to approve new purchases. And this hasn't stopped. The Heritage Foundation is still working in the background and still exerting a lot of influence over the potential future Trump admin. These last weeks, Trump has tried everything to portray Project 2025 as an extreme platform he has nothing to do with, despite all the evidence to the contrary and the huge overlap between the project and his Agenda 47.
As you know, and as she knows better than anyone, I have nothing to do with Project 2025.
But behind the scenes, Heritage doesn't care about their project being slandered like this. They know their power is safe, that the corporate interest that they represent will still get their wish, and that they'll be able to calmly, strategically consume the U.S. government and place ever more power into the hands of a conservative president removed from any sort of democratic accountability. Here, just watch this undercover recording of Russ Vought captured by the Center for Climate Reporting.
I expected to hear 10 more times from the rally the president, you know, distancing himself from the left's boogeyman of Project 2025.
Yeah. And you're not worried about that?
I'm not worried about it.
Okay.
He's running against the brand. He is not running against any people.
Okay.
He is not running against any institutions. It's interesting. He's, in fact, not even opposing himself to a particular policy.
Yeah.
He's been at our organization. He's raised money for our organization. He's 80% of my time is working on the plans of what's necessary to take control of these bureaucracies. And we are working doggedly on that.
This is how the next stage of American-style fascism could be ushered in. Not through any grand insurrectionary displays, not through a military seizure of power. Slowly. Thanks to the steady work of Christian nationalists like Vought and the Project 2025 team at Heritage, backed by anonymous corporate donors, leading a meticulously thought-out program to dismantle progressive coalitions and bring the business community's interest back to the top of the policy agenda. Crushing the working class and countless at-risk groups along the way, gutting what little democratic expression we do have, and giving unchecked power to a monarch who'll just follow the blueprint. And if it doesn't happen this election cycle, then it almost certainly will next time. American decline is a slow, boring process. It won't be like you see in the movies. No civil war, no dramatic coup, just capital doing what capital does. Making a life of dignity and economic security impossible for all of us to pad their pockets a little bit more. And if you don't think they'll embrace full-on fascism to make a quick buck, you're in for a rude awakening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.